Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
For our first segment of today's What's Next episode from Jamestown, we catch up with Casey Coburn, the founder of CACO, an arts and cultural center in Jamestown, to discuss what she's been up to since her last appearance on What's Next.
So now where are you at right now? So you said the grant expired.
Mm-hmm.
Explain to me, like, you know, what that has meant for you.
Well, it definitely was, you know, luckily for me, I have my husband who works and has a really good job. And so I think I was better off because of that, but still, you know, being independent and wanting to keep CACO going, it kind of left things a little bit unknown, like what was going to happen. And so now I'm actually kind of put back on my dog training lifestyle and kind of got that going again, and I'm doing that at the local Humane Society.
Okay, all right. So, but you're still creating art.
Yep.
All right. Do you have a name for this exhibit?
This exhibit is Birds Through an Indigenous Lens.
Okay, all right. So that's an intriguing name.
Yes.
So let's talk about seeing birds through an Indigenous lens. Obviously, we're talking about your lens, but yeah, I know your mother is part of it as well. So what does that mean? What do you see, I guess, is what are you seeing through that lens?
So really, I mean, it's a conversation about the effects of colonization on conservation. And so I have an affinity when it comes to the environment and animal advocacy and just working with animals. And so I thought, you know, what's a better way to do that than art? And it really kind of was a way for me to show the immediate community too what being an Indigenous artist is. It's not just corn husks, though I have elements of that. It's not just ribbon skirts, although I have elements of that in here. It's so much more. It's whatever we want it to be. I mean,
sure.
We're human beings and artists just the same as anybody else who are human beings and artists, and we can have multiple talents and show that.
And so let's talk about, when I was here before, you know, like you said, the corn husks and beads, it was such a prominent part of what we discussed, and you had that real great connection and commitment, it seemed, to the traditional arts. I like a lot of it because of your mother. But at the same time, you know, for a variety of reasons, you're kind of maybe moving on to some different things here. How has it been maybe making that transformation?
I think the traditional arts will always be a part of my work. Maybe not in every single exhibit, but it's still going to kind of bleed through here and there because it's a part of me. It's a part of my life. And like here with the Birds Through Indigenous Lens exhibit, I have elements that reflect the beadwork design. And there is actual beadwork also involved that kind of shows a lot of the tradition, but it's in a way that connects back to conservation. So I chose to do designs with medicine. So I've got strawberries and a sunflower on the wall, and then I've got some glass, I'm not sure what we would call those, I guess, little terrariums that have living plants in them, living aquarium plants in them, and it's done in the design of the daisy chain, which is really kind of cool. And everything in here also glows in the dark, which is bringing that modern aspect to it, kind of that like neon jungle type of vibe. It's just what I was trying to go for and really show the effects of colonization and conservation with it. So I really wanted the room to really read that. And so that's kind of how my traditional stuff still kind of impacts and affects my modern work as well.
Right. And as you were embracing the traditional, what did you learn about yourself as an artist? And, you know, because that became kind of your medium to a certain extent, or a big part of what you're focusing on. I'm wondering if, you know, for you as the artist, what type of growth did you sense, or is it, you know, something that was helping you connect to ancestry? What was it?
So it's kind of a double-edged sword as an artist, just because it becomes something that everybody just, that's the only thing that they want from you, right? Mm. And so then the only conversation you can have about anything is your identity as an Indigenous person. And then it becomes more about education and like going through like an entire history book worth of education in just a short amount of time. And that was starting to become like my, like all of my interactions with people. And so it started feeling very toxic because it was the only thing that people wanted from me was to be Indian. And it's a fantastic thing to be. And I'm happy that people are interested and want to hear it, but it's also a lot on a single individual person. And in this immediate community, like I'm the only guy kind of representing that. And so it was a lot to ask of one person. But it, you know, has the other side where it has been a blessing to be able to talk about these things and promote it and, you know, preserve everything that my mom preserved for me and be able to pass that down and provide it for the other Indigenous families that aren't here. So it's good positives, but then it can very quickly become a toxic thing too. So it's just about me trying to navigate that and talking to other artists that have had very similar experiences where they're like, oh yeah, you know, we kind of noticed that, you know, schools are only calling us around Thanksgiving. You know, or schools only want to talk to us about, you know, this certain thing. And, it, you know, if we try to step outside that box, then it's like, oh, no, thank you. We don't want you anymore. Another hard thing, too, is people think that these things, especially materials, apparently just manifest. And so there's almost this idea that culture is should be free. And culture should be, you know, I should just freely give it and there should, you know, they shouldn't have to pay for the workshops or anything like that. So that's, I've had a few awkward conversations where they're like, oh, what do you mean it's going to cost? Well, because it costs me money to go get the corn.
And you're a professional.
Yeah.
Professional.
And it costs time and a lot of stuff goes into it. So I think just as an Indigenous artist and, you know, somebody who is providing culture side to it too, I have to kind of not really gatekeep it, but protect it from that type of thing. Because it isn't, it shouldn't be a gimmick thing. It's not like a party event. And I'm not an entertainer with it.
Right. Yeah. That's an interesting perspective. And it makes me think about a lot of the work. And as you say, you know, I couldn't help but think about what you said about, oh, we only get called when it's Thanksgiving. Almost like there's this expectation of you that maybe overlooks the actual creative part of your work. Would you say that's right?
Yeah, I think so. And it kind of, they also kind of with it want me to push this false narrative of, you know, this happy Thanksgiving idea that, you know, the pilgrims and the natives just sat down and had this wonderful meal together, which is not true. And so I've had a couple of conversations where I'm like, are you sure you want me to come to this and, you know, everybody's sitting and having a wonderful time and then you want me to tell them about genocide? Like, that's maybe not the right time to do that, you know? But I guess I will, like, if you want me to, like, but I've this year I decided, you know what, I'm going to just limit it to just a few choice events that I want to do around that time of year. and Ujima out in Buffalo actually contacted me, and they had their Thanksgiving play, which is a complete, I don't know if you got a chance to see it or talk to them about it, but it was brilliant. And it was written by the first Native American female playwright, which I thought was fantastic also. And so it had a much different type of narrative and everything surrounding it. And the presentation was just absolutely awesome. So they did a really fantastic job. So I've just had to really be, I guess, more picky about the events that I choose to be a part of. And then that way I'm kind of saving myself from, you know, the possibility of entering toxic situations or tokenization. And it's been weird. And I know that a lot of other Indigenous artists are going through the same thing and trying to find a way to navigate that too, because you don't want to not have the opportunities come knocking, but at the same time, you don't got to answer every door.
Right. And you want to be a serious artist.
Yeah.
And you want people to see your art, consume your art in a serious fashion.
Yeah.
Makes all the sense in the world. Let's talk a little bit more about this particular exhibit then. So, I mean, it's a real beautiful, and it does have a certain vibe to it, doesn't it? So what can you take us through the process? What brought you to this? Or it's just one of those things as you're going along, maybe the muse tells you where to go?
Well, I definitely have a few muses. It's a little bit like Pandora's box, a little bit with creativity for me. But really, I guess I came together because I had an idea for advocacy. I've always enjoyed macaws, and so this this exhibit has a strong focus on macaw conservation. And so I'm like, you know what? I want to draw them. I have a macaw at home. Her name is Freya, and a lot of fun. But a lot of people don't know that much information about them. So I'm like, this will be a cool opportunity for them. And you know, I'm involved with the Roger Torrey Peterson Institute, and so I'm like, birds are kind of on the brain anyways, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, I'll do this. And then I had ideas for, like, I wanted to make it so it looked like beadwork was actually on the wall, kind of like a relief project type of, relief sculpture type of thing, and just kind of bring all of those elements back in.
Right.
And the idea of glow in the dark and neon, I absolutely love that. My last one, the Haunted Spaces, was also very glow in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love that, playing with lights and playing with the different colors and just seeing how it all comes together. So it kind of gave me an opportunity to really put those all together and think about different things. And as I was doing it, I knew that it was the right move because I had other people that are also involved with, like, conservation and things that were like, oh, did you see this article or did you see this document, and like all these different things. And I'm like, okay, so this is something that is current, that's, you know, coming up right now. And like right now in the news, because of climate change, which is largely attributed to colonization, because colonization really did reshape the entire globe and everything. And right now we have birds, parrots, that are coming up from South America up here because it's getting to be too warm.
Mm.
And so we are starting to see a good change like that. I'm hoping it's a good change. I love birds, so I would like to see them, but maybe it would be better if I saw them in their natural habitat.
Yeah, I love birds as well. And as a matter of fact, as I look at this display, you have probably my favorite, which is, I believe that's a bald eagle over there.
That is.
So how does the bald eagle get in with the macaws?
Well, he is our native bird. And I wanted to kind of bring into the idea that all of this can happen here, right? So down in South America, I was told by Dr. Stallman, he was the director of the Seneca Museum when I worked there. And he was telling me about a couple of tribes that are actually using plastic straws in replace of macaw feathers because of conservation things and birds literally going extinct. They don't have access to their cultural items. And so I was like, well, what would that feel like then for me as an Indigenous person? What would that feel like for us as an Indigenous tribe? What would that look like? And so he kind of is here to kind of bring that in to play and just show the similarities. They, as you know, eat squirrels and everything else. Well, so does a macaw. A macaw will actually actively hunt.
I thought they only ate seeds.
No, no. Nope.
I've only seen them in a zoo, that's why.
Yep, they will eat little lizards and all sorts of stuff. So, and actually, the large macaws, so the green wing and the hyacinth macaw, have a PSI, a bite force of up to 2,000 PSI, which can easily snap a broom handle seconds.
Wow.
And people don't know that, and they bring them into their home, and they're like, oh, my God, I have this monster. And it, you know, they're comical monsters, so people do love them. But they do have this, and so, like, I'll see people on, like, TikTok and things that'll have these birds, and they bring them right up to their face, and they're doing kissy sounds, and I'm like, it looks so cute until it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And they can do a lot of damage. So they really do need to have a little bit more respect when it comes to owning them as pets, because they're not really supposed to be domesticated. So it definitely is very interesting. And they feel like fat turkeys when they're sitting on your arm too. So they're not little.
Fat turkeys who can bite your finger in half. Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Nice. And then kind of going with that idea though of bringing it home and with the plastic straw idea, I do also have a gustawa that I made out of plastic straws.
Oh.
And I did that deliberately because I wanted to see what that would look like, right? If they're using it for their headdresses, what would that look like for us to use plastic straws then for our headdresses? And I don't like it.
Oh, okay.
My mom, like, she could identify it immediately what I was trying to go for, so it does look like it's what it's supposed to intend. But to me, it looks like garbage, and I don't wish that on us at all. So okay. Hopefully we never, ever have to rely on something like that.
But. Yeah. What do you want people to know about this exhibit?
I think, you know, it's here. It'll be up for a little while, till spring.
Oh, okay.
And if anybody wants to come see it, just message me and come on in. So everything is done privately right now because I'm working at the Humane Society as their behaviorist. And so I'm doing that so that I could keep Keiko going. Yeah. So as an artist coming out of a very large grant, that was kind of my path forward.
Yeah.
So we'll probably see a lot of animal-based exhibits and things going forward because I might as well blend the two.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, so what's next then for you in terms of art? If the exhibit's up now, that means there's something that you're probably working on right now, and you may not want to give me all the specifics, but what about maybe some areas that you're trying to take your art toward?
Well, I am working towards an exhibit for the summer where I'm going to talk about a lot of the unlovables, right? Like animals that we don't necessarily care too much for. I currently have a piece here that will probably carry over into that one, which has a lot of little bugs on it.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't like creepy crawlies, right? So bats and snakes and things, that'll be a big element within that. And I think that'll be kind of important, especially talking about conservation and things, talking about adoptable animals. A lot of times people don't like black cats or, you know, black dogs. And that's because we have it's called the black dog bias, where we have like a fear of it, right? We think about the Bible, and then they have the black dog that is like, you're not supposed to be able to see because then it's like something demonic. And we have a lot of fear regarding that. And the hope is that I can kind of break that down and say, it's a little bit silly, like they're fine.
Right.
So,
right.
And I guess I'll give with that, like a good example, we have Enzo at the Humane Society right now, who is a black dog, and he's super cute. He doesn't like other dogs or cats, but that's okay. Not every home has a dog and a cat. So, but he's super chill and really, really well-behaved dogs.
Do you think you get along with your macaw?
You know, he might. So I don't know if he's ever seen one before, but he's more so just about play and being outside. And he actually will play hockey with you. So he'll push the ball back for you. And yeah, it was a whole thing. And
And this is a final question. It's somewhat personal, and if you want to move past it, it's fine. But I'm wondering, to hear you talk, and I know when we talked before, so much of your identity, but I can tell your spirit, your soul, is in your art. Where has this been a time for, not an identity crisis, but where you're trying to figure out where you're going, who you're going to be? Is that something that's on your mind in a way?
I think really it's just about me standing up for myself. And, largely with the indigenous, front to all of my art, that was me standing up for my community and for, directly for my mom, who has had to fight for that indigenous identity.
And if I recall your mom's story, she was among the people that was displaced by Kinswood Dam, right?
Yep. Yeah. And she's not white passing, and she's been through so much, and then to have people still say, because she doesn't have that enrollment card, oh, you're not indigenous. I still am holding that shield up for that part of the community and saying, we're not going to do that here, because that is also a part of colonization, right? Blood quantum and all that. That is what they intended. They wanted us to no longer exist. And so I will still kind of be holding that shield up for everybody, but I also need to hold up the shield and say, hey, I'm also pagan. I'm also a dog trainer. I'm also just an artist and just a person, and I don't have to fit inside a box for you. And so that's really, I think, what Keiko is it can adapt and change and be whatever I need it to.
Yeah, I don't think anyone will ever put you in a box, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Casey, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more to come. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Did you know that Buffalo Toronto Public Media produces shows that earn New York Emmy nominations and awards, Webby Awards, Telly Awards, GLAAD nominations, and New York State Broadcaster Association Awards? Check out our award-winning productions like Compact Science, Compact History, Let's Go, Brave Spaces, Klein Hands Gift to Buffalo, and much more on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel or visit WNED.org. This is public media. We at Buffalo Toronto Public Media take pride in bringing you your favorite national programs like Fresh Air, All Things Considered, and Morning Edition. But what makes WBFO so special are its local programs, learning together about how government works in bite-sized pieces on Compact Civics with host Corey McCamps.
Here's a quick guide on polling locations. A polling place is where you cast your ballot during elections. In America, the term polling place refers to the building, while polling station refers to the specific room or area where voting happens.
And diving into pop culture and local happenings on Group Chat with host Bentley and a revolving panel of friends in the know.
I really miss having to actually wait to tune in for a show and be there at the certain time, like having to run home and like turn on the TV at a certain time to like watch your show.
Yes. Like more national unity then too.
Yes.
Like we're all tuned in.
Everybody is watching at the same time, and you can like call and
ever
say,
since
did you
streaming
see what
happened? It's just gone downhill.
This is public media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
For the next segment of today's What's Next episode in Jamestown, we're proud to bring you a one-on-one conversation with Dahoud. Dahoud is one of the new neighbors in Jamestown, coming from Syria. With Sam Kadri acting as translator, Jay Moran sits down with Dahoud to discuss what his transition to Jamestown has been like, the importance of him having free speech to take today's interview, as well as the current situation in Syria.
Welcome back to What's Next here in Jamestown today, talking with the New Neighbors Coalition, which has worked to welcome 125 refugees to the Jamestown area since February of 2023 and helping other people as well. We have a chance right now with Sam Kadri, acting as our interpreter, to talk to Dahoud. Dahoud is from Syria, came here 7 months ago. Dahoud, how do you like Jamestown so far?
كمعيشة فيها المعيشة حلوة وكالتعليم فيها التعليم حلو وكمجتمع المجتمع كله مجتمع إنساني ما بيعاملك كالو إلا لون ولا بشرة ولا دين ولا عرق ولا أي شيء يعاملك كإنسان.
That was a saying basically that the situation in Jamestown, he finds that it's very welcoming. He hasn't found any type of a discrimination personally from his experience. He finds that there are opportunities for himself and for his family, education-wise, for his children to be educated and grow up in the area.
Of course, Dawu, you come from Syria, and Syria has been in the news in the last couple of days. This is very fresh as we are recording this particular. What did you think of the regime change in Syria?
كما تعلم أخ داود إنك أنت طبعاً جاي من سوريا وكما هلأ نحن نسجل هذا البرنامج بخلال اليومين أو بعض الأيام اللي مضت حصل حاجة مهمة جداً بالبلد بسوريا اللي هو تغيير النظام. برأيك أو ما رأيك باللي حصل بسوريا بالوقت الحاضر بالنسبة لك؟
أنا عشت بسوريا وانتقلت بأزمة الحرب عشت 10 سنين في لبنان.
I lived in Syria for 10 years and then I moved to Lebanon.
بسبب الحرب.
كم سنة عشت؟
10 سنين.
بلبنان. 10 years in Lebanon.
Okay.
Yeah, he moved to Lebanon.
All right.
اللي شفناه إنه النظام نظام قاتل نظام مجرم.
What we found and experienced was that the system in the Syrian government was a very aggressive and criminal almost to the point of criminology there.
ليس عندك حرية تعبير.
You don't have any freedom of expression.
ليس عندك أمان.
You don't have any sense of safety or security.
ما عندك التعليم لأطفالك. ما عندك كلمة اللي بدك تحكيها.
Education for children lacking. Any word you want to say, you want to wait, think before you open your mouth and say it.
واللي شفناه آخر شيء بسجن صيدنايا بيحدث عن يعني شغلات كثيرة من التعذيب والإجرام العقل ما بيتحمل.
Specifically, he mentions that there's a one jail called Sadnaya Jail in Syria where a lot of torture was happening, a lot of activities that were human rights violation activities that sometimes the mind can't comprehend or take that.
Do you have family still in Syria?
I have my mom and my dad there still.
How are they?
كيف حالهم الآن؟
والله الحمد لله لأنه هن عايشين تقريباً بالأرياف.
Thank God they're okay now. They're living just out on the outskirts of the city that he was from. They're fairly okay. They're doing okay for now.
I know it's all very fresh, but do you have a desire to ever go back to Syria?
أنا أعلم إنه الحادث اللي بيحصل الحوادث اللي حصلت لسه جديدة جدا ولكن هل عندك أي شعور إنك ممكن ترجع على سوريا بأي وقت من الأوقات؟
هلا شعور ما في. أنا أمنيتي إني أدرس أطفالي أعلمهم خرجهم.
I don't have any such a feeling at this time. I'm focused, he says, I'm focused on trying to help my children receive the best education they can here in the area.
وعندي بنتي ماريا شاطرة يعني بدها تطلع دكتورة.
My daughter Maria, she has expressed her opinion that she wants to, one of her dream is to become a doctor.
موظفهم بيجي مستوان نفتح العيادة.
So he's of course the part of the vision that his daughter has and he has is that hopefully we'll prepare her here in Jamestown, we'll help her get the education and eventually maybe she'll become a doctor and open her own clinic here in Jamestown.
And did she have that dream? Could that dream have been fulfilled in Syria?
هل كان عندها هذا الحلم بسوريا وهل إذا كان عندها هذا الحلم بسوريا ممكن إنه يحصل أو يتحقق؟
هي درست 10 سنين بلبنان. هي لما طلعت من سوريا عمرها سنة سنتين تقريبا لما طلعت من سوريا.
When Maria left Syria, she was just about a year or 2 years. And then when they went, that's what the time when they moved to Lebanon. بلبنان
كانت متفوقة بلبنان وعندها الحلم يعني.
وكان الحلم موجود
حلم أن تكون طبيبة جراحة.
Yeah, he says Maria was also very, you know, good student in Lebanon, and she did have that dream okay. when she was in Lebanon. And I'm gonna follow up again with him to make sure I get the as far as doability. هل ممكن إنه كان ماريا يكون عندها الحلم يتحقق بلبنان بالك ولا صعب؟
لا صعب. لبنان كان.
He says no. It would have been difficult.
Final question.
Final question.
How do you like the snow?
I think he understood that one. Snow. كيف لقيت الترجمة؟ كيف لقيت الترجمة؟
نعم ممتاز. وحاب أتشكر جميع اللي ساعدونا من هون، الأخ سامي غادري، أستاذ لوكا مؤمنة، جميع المنظمين، أماندا، صابرينا، وخاصة دكتور العائلة روبن، يعني شكر خاص كثير لهم. Yeah.
So kind, like that. So he says, yeah, you know, the snow will get used, but he right away opened up and he says he'd like to thank the community for receiving him and his family. And specifically, he began mentioning names. Mentioned that his family physician, Dr. Wow. Robbins, at the Stauffer Center. Mm-hmm. He also specifically thanked Father Luke, Momina, and Amanda from Journey's End. Umi Kamat.
Sabrina,
also Journey's End. The folks who worked with him and actually who were instrumental in helping him resettle. And also his English teachers.
I was going to say, I think you can understand English.
Yeah, he
doesn't speak it that well.
So he's working on that too. And I like that. This is cool. So he's expressing his sincere appreciation to his teachers and the folks who are helping him and his family and his children resettle here in his new home here in Jamestown.
Dawood, thank you very much for being with us on What's Next.
شكراً لك إنك
شكراً لكم ولقناتكم.
البرنامج اللي اسمه What's Next.
شكراً لهم للقناة ولجميع المنظمين.
Thank you for your programming and your show and for the whole community, and we appreciate it.
Take a time out on What's Next and come back with more from Jamestown. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Our mission at Buffalo Toronto Public Media is to serve our local community. And on WBFO, we do that by keeping you informed and connected to your community, whether it's by hearing from a local Black poet about what it was like to move from the inner city to the suburbs on What's Next.
So that emotional change with that culture change combined led me realize that basketball and being physical wasn't enough. I needed a way to figure out my emotions. So the first poem I wrote in the cafetorium of Sweet Home Middle School was Outcast.
Or it's exploring the East Side Garden Walk.
It's wonderful that we're seeing engagement in beautification and sharing gardens, because we believe that we can build more vibrant communities by sharing our gardens, by sharing our stories, and by building real connections between people. We came through as neighbors and cleaned the space out and began plot by plot putting plants in.
This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
For our next segment in today's special episode from Jamestown, Jay Moran sits down with Reverend Luke Fedor, Mamina de Blasio, and Sam Kadri from the New Neighbors Coalition based out of St. Luke's Episcopal Church. The four talk about the mission of the New Neighbors Coalition and the important work that the group does.
Yeah. And so we've met lots of folks from Colombia and Cuba and other places that are coming here. I think the small town life really is attractive to people sometimes, you know. So I think they hear about it, and then the cost of living is so such a huge impact. If you're going to try and start with nothing, being able to be in a place where you can find affordable housing, you can find a neighbor who's willing to be there for you, makes a huge difference. And then to find a welcoming community makes it, that gives a little nudge over the edge to really make it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say, like Luke said, the affordability really makes a big difference. I think we don't necessarily always have the infrastructure and the knowledge as a community in how to work with folks who weren't born in the U.S. I think that's kind of the other side of it. That can be a bit of a challenge. But we've been really fortunate to have wonderful volunteers, but also community partners that even with the struggles have always been very open and very willing to help and support and adapt. Like Luke said, since we're not really a federal agency, like the bulk of our work is in welcoming people, kind of doing that community like integration, that community engagement piece of welcoming people at a deeper level, and being a support for them. It's less about like a monetary thing, which we still do some emergency things, but a lot of what we do is educating the community and trying to create opportunities to connect the local born community, both on the organizational level, but just the community at large, with new neighbors in a way that's by trying to facilitate language services and in translation, interpretation, and just furthering, kind of trying to go bridge that gap, that information gap that can exist when you're from a different language or different culture or come from a different place.
One of the things we do is celebrate culture. So there's every year a World Refugee Day or Displaced Persons Day that we have celebrated for the last 3 years. Just this last year, we rented Winter Garden Plaza, had an outdoor festival. We had Henna Art, Sakanya Dance Studio, who's also been on What's Next before, was performing. And we had all kinds of cultural food, some donuts, which I can't remember the name.
Mandazi
from the Congo. And then we had some Middle Eastern treats as well that were kind of part of that celebration. So we try and help celebrate culture and to let people know that all of us have culture.
But the other side of the coin is that now we find ourselves also teaching those families about traditions, American traditions.
Okay. Yeah.
Simple, good, great American tradition.
Like Thanksgiving.
So Thanksgiving went over big.
I loved it.
Yeah,
we had about 100,
couple of years.
120 people here for Thanksgiving.
Over here?
This past Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Sam drove and got like 14 halal turkeys.
The turkeys, yeah, brought halal turkeys. Because remember, you know, we in Islam, we can't eat pork, or we can't eat non-halal meats. We can't drink alcohol, wine and all that. So I thought, what can we do? We talked to Luke, and the suggestion was, how about we bring halal turkeys, and everybody eats halal turkeys. So we played the whole table, all halal turkeys.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of a small accommodation. Mm-hmm. Instead of separating and saying, okay, here's your food. No, everybody ate. I don't think they cared.
No. It makes it easier on the people who prep. You don't have to think about who's having what.
And it still tasted great.
Yeah.
And it's still, you know, the stuffing, the trimming, everything that came with a perfect night for a Thanksgiving.
We deliberately do it on Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Because
it's
a holiday for us. Then often
so everybody's off.
Everyone's off. But everyone knows it's a holiday.
Yeah.
Even if you don't understand, it's not your holiday. Your kids are off school. You know that this is a holiday. And where are you going to go? So being invited to a space. Of course, we also invited some of the international students from Jamestown Community College to come join us too. So it was a great celebration of culture.
It became like a big family.
Yeah. Right.
Literally, this is how it felt.
Yeah.
I swear,
yeah.
This is how it felt. Man, you know, we some of us don't have families here, so you know, extended families, and then the feeling became, you know, I'm going to be, you know, celebrating Thanksgiving here with Luke and the family. St. Luke's Church.
Yeah.
Imagine that, right? Jamestown Slime Society members. Like, St. Luke's Church eating Thanksgiving dinners. Mm-hmm. And we loved it.
Yeah.
But again, the sense of experience that for those new immigrant families or refugee families who became just brand new Americans, mm-hmm. are celebrating their first Thanksgiving. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we want. We want to teach them about our culture here, American culture. We want to teach them about what we do and how we do it, in addition to, of course, showing them the ropes and mm-hmm. how to live life in America.
Well, I can certainly see and hear why they would want to come to Jamestown, right? It's so welcoming for sure. And we know that there, like we said, there are others who have made their way here with a variety of statuses that hopefully someday will be part of the community in a different status as well. At the same time, you know, Jamestown quite publicly back in the summertime, there was a I guess it was even declared an emergency, and I almost hate to use an overhyped term, but that there were people without homes and living not too far from here down along the river. How does that jibe with the idea that you're trying to find housing for new Americans?
Housing is always a challenge across the country. We all know there's a housing crisis. There's just simply not enough quality housing or housing, period, for folks. And so we're not trying to see this as a scarcity situation, but as the more people who get involved with the state of our housing, the more the community can go, oh, this is not right. Because we have systemic problems, not just, you know, that house or this house. It's we don't have enough.
Okay.
And so the more volunteers that we get involved, the more community leaders that actually see the struggle firsthand, because it's always a tale of two cities in America, right?
Yeah.
Those who have and those who don't. And that's the scenario. If we're only living with a world of abundance, you don't know that you should be agitated or that things could be different.
Yeah.
And so how to work for it.
We don't have enough good housing landlords that are held accountable for the for this state of the
housing. And I was going to ask, there's enough housing stock, yes? But maybe not high quality and needs to be upgraded, or just, I mean, I'll accept the clarification.
It's an older, obviously, housing stock that we have in Jamestown. So there would be a little bit of a struggle for some families to... The families we've been getting, large number of family members, say to the tone of between 6 to 8 members. And in order for a family who wants to come and resettle or brought mm-hmm. to resettle here in Jamestown, you need a 4-bedroom house or 4-bedroom apartment.
Mm.
And those are rare.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not easy to find a 4-bedroom house or a 4-bedroom apartment. And then now you would settle for the 3-bedroom apartment for a family of 8.
Mm.
And now, okay, now you have to also almost negotiate with the owner, with the landlord.
Mm-hmm.
Landlord does not want to rent that number of people to a 2-bedroom house or apartment or 3-bedroom apartment. There might be some issues with the city codes, and I can't remember what was the issue with this sometimes, but or accountability mm-hmm. issues, and mm-hmm. I can't remember some of them. But anyways, there is a challenge there as far as the housing is concerned. Mm-hmm. A couple of families we've had in the past moved out of town somewhere else because they couldn't find the appropriate house or apartment for them for their children, just because it happens to be a larger, you know, family number of individuals in the families. So they found a place maybe somewhere in Buffalo, or actually the ones that
Syracuse.
How did they find it? Well, buddies now, friends. Hey, you know, what do you know there? Well, who do you have? And can you find me a spot? And one family we've had a case stayed in the hotel for 6 months. That is unheard of, you know. And I totally understood the situation. I totally understand the challenge here. The staff couldn't basically find a spot for them. They had to stay in the hotel. Because their kids began going to school from the hotel, you know, and transporting back and forth between the hotel and the schools, you know, middle school and high school, elementary school, and the rest of them were middle school level. But that's something that, I don't know, possibly a discussion to be had
about
that eventually at some point or another, you know, community-wise or...
I think what happens, though, is once a family gets established, once that first home ownership happens, the model is a reinvestment. I mean, an older housing stock is challenging because if you're thinking about return on investment, you know, there's a challenge. But we have taken a page from Binghamton. We, on our first World Refugees Day, we screened a film called, not Binghamton, Utica.
Utica,
The Last Refuge.
Yeah.
And what we saw in Utica was this drastic redevelopment but at the hands of refugees and of new neighbors who showed up and rebuilt houses. They used the skills they had to like reinvest and to take older housing stock and revitalize it in a sustainable way. So I think once we get that first house being owned by a new neighbor, then the course their buddies will be coming, hey, what else you got in Jamestown for us? And then we'll see that reinvestment that helps kind of address the situation.
And ultimately, it's not new neighbor. It's not who's getting the housing. It's not there is... It's not, we're not pitting groups against each other and there's no competition. It's how are we holding, you know, these kind of ghost landlords and these properties accountable and making sure that we're fostering and we're trying to incentivize better housing. Mm-hmm. Like
safe housing, safety, right. You know, important issues, safety and meeting the code, city code, make sure that the house doesn't have any lead, you know, stuff like that is looked at also by the agency, and they actually monitor that. They walk in, they check place before they even bring the family in. Yeah. So that's also monitored very closely.
I don't necessarily want to take you and take this scope out too far, but you might have a lot of thoughts about this. So sounds like here in Jamestown, you've got a pretty good local partner, a government partner that is on board with a lot of what you're doing here. And it does, and even on the state level, the Office of New Americans. But at the same time, whether it's housing or whatever the case may be, what are some of the things that maybe you could see on whether a state or national level from legislation or anything like that, things that you've heard that could really help make these situations even a smoother situation, something that can kind of break down these walls as we're moving along here?
I think the question of employment and employability is always a key thing. Like, how do you help the employers get people into the workforce faster? Yep. That's a challenge. You know, in certain cases, we've got folks who maybe don't have documentation. We have folks in town who were born here but don't have documentation. It's an ongoing thing. Yeah. So how can we help in that kind of level of assisting folks get documentation or find workable ways forward so they're not having to work in compromised ways?
Yeah.
I would say at a national, federal level, immigration reform. A lot of people don't know. The only way to seek asylum is to show up at the border and to be let in. That is the only way that it's done. You can only seek asylum once you enter the country, and you can only remain in the asylum-seeking process if you stay in the country.
Correct.
So it's a
but you can't work.
But you can't work.
Yeah. But you can't work.
Well, you have to run for 6 months.
For 6 months.
Until you get a work permit.
For 6 months after you file for asylum, and you have a year to file for asylum. So you could go 18 months without working.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just an old system. We need reform on a national level that goes beyond every, what we can do locally. And it also, it would do a lot for a lot of... a lot of sides are complaining about immigration, but kind of in the same way. Yeah. It's very backed up.
It appears very chaotic.
Mm-hmm. It's very chaotic. There's no other way to go about doing things, and so that's just kind of very big picture. But
no, I appreciate that, because I think that gets lost.
Understanding that this is the only way to do it, and then not changing that, keeping it the same way, but then getting frustrated when people... try to function within the system that they have available to them is a little unfair sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Sam, any thoughts?
Well, I've been thinking about what our city is actually doing. There's quite a bit is being done actually in City of Jamestown's city council members have taken the approach of we would like to hold those landlords accountable.
Okay.
And I love the idea. I think this is a wonderful step in the right direction towards improving our housing stock from a local perspective, and that's really good. Meaning, from my understanding, that if you have a rental property, investment rental property, you have to register it. You have to, you know, there's a process, there's procedures. You know, if there's a violation or something, they're going to be, you know, watching, you know, what's happening, where the violation is, who's violating who, where. And then they'll have a strict follow-up on that. And that's the gist of my understanding.
Sure.
Which is, it really sounds awesome. And we want something to be done about those rundown properties that are in town and that need to be maybe just literally just demolished and rebuilt somehow by investors, new investors in the area. That's probably what it's going to take. It's going to take someone who's going to say, I have a vision that Jamestown 10 years from now will have a little bit of improvement, and I want to be part of that improvement, and I want to be part of that vision of building a new Jamestown as far as property and rental property and investment property is concerned. I think that would be awesome.
And the best way to incentivize that is to have people moving here and coming here to rent these properties.
Well, we are out of time here. This has been an incredible conversation. I appreciate you giving us the time to be here. I guess maybe I'll just some final thoughts. We'll go around the table. We'll start with you, Momina. I mean, you do this work. You're hopeful for what's ahead?
Yeah. I think everything, you know, everything said and done. I moved to Jamestown 5 years ago. Ultimately, it's a very welcoming community. I like to think that the Facebook comments that we see all the time aren't really indicative of the people.
It's amazing how brave people can be on Facebook.
Yeah. Of the community. 99.99% of people I've encountered have always been friendly and kind and open and very welcoming. And it's a privilege. I feel privileged and honored to get to live in this community. And I want everyone to feel that way, you know, on both sides of either, you know, being locally born here or people or new neighbors who are coming. And I think there's always an opportunity to create that, to foster that a little more.
Sam, how about for you? You're doing it. You're a volunteer. You're the volunteer who's on 24/7.
If I may put a plug in for volunteering.
Yes.
Here's my take.
What's the benefit of volunteering?
Oh, my goodness. Self-satisfaction on accomplishment. Mm. You know, and when we talked earlier in the break, and I did mention that I'm also a driver's ed teacher in public schools and the private setting. I should have taken pictures of every time that I've had one of those new family, new neighbors at the site, at the testing site in Faulkner, and we're doing high fives. I just passed. Okay, good. Now you're hugging and giving high fives to everybody. The whole family is laughing because you know what? And they've never had the opportunity to learn how to drive.
Mm.
They were denied, not just because they didn't want to. It's because they were denied the opportunity to be able to drive a vehicle in the refugee camp that they were in or in the city that they were displaced to during the war in Syria between whether it's between Jordan and Syria or Jordan or Syria and Lebanon. Either direction, those folks, they value everything. Like I said, you and I take driving for granted. Mm. They don't. Right? All the way from the very beginning. Right turn, left turn, straight. We teach them the language, of course. You know, you got to understand that the English component to the driving task. You have to be able to read the signs, right? So volunteering then, to me, becomes so significant that not only I feel so good about what I'm seeing, and I'm a teacher. When I see a student getting the job done and they're performing well, I'm happy. That's all I want. That's all I want. It's all, of course, volunteer. We don't charge them anything, obviously. Driving lessons or the 5-hour pre-licensing course or the, you know, defensive driving, anything. Anyway, I told him from the beginning. I told Luke from the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. I said, anyone who comes at my doorstep and shows me their passport and they're a new refugee, right, they're in the free ride. So, and I do that from the, you know, bottom of my heart without any hesitation. And I would like to encourage others to do the same. Mm-hmm. You have a skill, you have an experience that you'd like to share, you'd like to help with, whether you're in Jamestown or in Buffalo or within our listening area, you'd like to pitch in something, yeah, get a hold of Father Luke, St. Luke's Church here in Jamestown, New York. You know, Father Luke will be will give you a little bit of a direction on what to do and how to do it. But we would like more people to help out, just to help the process. And I think you'll feel better about it. You'll feel good about your life and what you accomplished. It doesn't have to be always material life, right?
Right.
It can be, you know, hey, I can take someone to the doctor's appointment or something. Give them a ride. Hey, you know, come on down.
And so, Reverend, Sam just gave you another job to do that. Oh, exactly. All these people are going to contact you. Yeah. But, but to that, this work, for you.
For me, it's really about a sense of agency, helping other people find that, and remembering that we get to build the cities that we live in. And we do that when we work in concert with others, when we tear down walls and really work on building up our houses. That, to me, is the reward that's worth it.
See, literally and figuratively.
Literally and figuratively.
Very well stated, Reverend Luke Fedor, Sam Kadri, and Momina de Blasio, thank you very much for being with us on What's
Next.
Thank you. This has been great. Thanks.
It's wonderful.
This has been... What's Next? From Jamestown, New York at St. Luke's Episcopal Church. And this is What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.